You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Okay, guys, our sponsor is DraftKings.com. Football season's just around the corner, and you can get your piece of $5 million during kickoff week at DraftKings.com. It's basically a one-week fantasy football site. You've already been scouting players for your season-long team. Use that knowledge to win instant cash at DraftKings.com. And apparently last year, one player turned $11 into $4,000 in one weekend. Another player won, ready, hold, $1 million in one day just playing fantasy football. But the cool thing is you better know your football. It does favor the person that knows the game. You've got to be skilled. It's not just by chance. Fantasy football is way more exciting at DraftKings.com when you can win huge cash starting the first week of the season. Because cash is exciting. It's the American way, ladies and gentlemen. So DraftKings.com. Bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. And guess what? If you use promo code Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, that's my last name, you'll get free entry into the week one $5 million kickoff bash. Enter Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, for free entry now at DraftKings.com. DraftKings.com. All right, ladies and gentlemen, my guest is Professor David Sloan Wilson, an American evolutionary biologist. He is a distinguished professor of biological sciences and anthropology at Binghamton University. He is essentially, he's a prominent proponent of the concept of group selection, known as multi-level selection and evolution. And we'll go through all of what that means. His books are Darwin's Cathedral, proposes that religion is a multi-level adaptation, a product of cultural evolution developed through a process of multi-level selection for most cooperative and cohesive groups. His book, Evolution for Everyone, How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives, is another one. And then his latest book is The Neighborhood Project, Using Evolution to Improve My City One Block at a Time. And he also, I believe, co-edited a book called Pathological Altruism, which I love. And we're going to get through all of this. I'm very excited. Let me start, Professor, with something that we very much appreciate about you. And I think that you stand alone in this, or, you know, at least in a very small group. The philosophical community, the religious community, and the scientific community stopped talking to each other a long time ago. And one of the things that Hunter and I always find is that there are always two camps. Scientists believe there's science, and religious people believe there's religion. For the most part, they're just not talking to each other.
And they spend their time saying what idiots the others are.
Yeah.
Which is just not a dialogue. It's just a shouting match, and that's a lot like much of American dialogue today.
You seem, Professor, to be trying to bridge the gap or get the two sides to be talking to each other, because both sides are very important to what's called being human. Take
well,
it from
that's
there.
That's right. That's right. And I, that is what I'm about, but I think I feel it necessary to say that there's a sizable silent majority, or at least a sizable fraction of people that are very science friendly. They're religious and they're science friendly, and mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the mainstream denominations are like that. So you know, it's not very sexy, and I think it might not get much attention for that reason. But I think it's a mistake to say that it's entirely a matter of two camps that are shouting at each other. There's a middle ground there, and I think that one of the things we want to do is to call attention to the middle ground in addition to, you know, basically giving it voice.
Mm. But you essentially contend that religion is something that, you know, human beings have evolved to create these communities. That is very human, to create a community. Religion is a product of that. Religion is, as human, we have evolved essentially to become religious. That's part of our evolution, our biological evolution, is it not?
Well, I'd say that we've evolved to become groupish. That's one point to make. So there's point number one. We have evolved to be groupish. I think that should be acknowledged by everyone as scientific fact. Another fact is that we are a symbolic species. So unlike other species, much of what we do is caused most proximately by our cultures and beliefs, not our genes. Our genes are distally involved, but not proximately, as involved. And then number three is that a religion is one kind of meaning system. So we all have a meaning system. Not a single human can exist without a meaning system. And often those meaning systems have the appearance of religion. That's how I would sequence the
By meaning system, you mean we need a meaning for why things happen. Whatever happens to us, there's got to be a reason behind it, in other words, right?
That's right. So, I mean, basically, one way I define a meaning system is something which receives environmental information as input and results in action as output, basically. And other species that don't have cultures, basically, they receive information as input, and that gets processed and results in action as output. But cultural information does not play a very big role in that. In humans, cultural information plays a huge role. So if you don't have a culture, as with, you know, feral children and things like that, well, you're just not functioning as a human. And so everybody is receiving information, and then they're processing that information with a meaning system. It's a system of beliefs, and it's a nebulous term, and we have to actually work on the vocabulary of it. But it's basically a set of beliefs, a symbolic systems of sorts that processes that information and then results in us doing things. That's what a meaning system is.
Wow.
And I think, you know, just as some helpful context, I mean, I was introduced to your work through the happiness hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt,
right,
who we also had on the podcast. And, you know, what he says in The Righteous Mind is that, you know, people like Richard Dawkins say that, you know, there's an evolutionary explanation for everything except religion, because the if they accepted that there was an evolutionary explanation for religion, then rather than just saying we shouldn't have it, they would have to acknowledge that it's part of who we are, right? They treat a religion as some sort of weird virus or artifact. But when, you know, over 90% of the world is religious, you have to allow that it's something that we evolved to be.
Well, let me amend that. So you guys are giving me good opportunities, good speaking points, basically.
Mm-hmm. We're very smart, Professor. Very smart.
And
I'm telling you, I'm having a great time here, and the level of intellectual discourse on this show is head and shoulders above most of what you can hear on the airwaves. I think that there is a controversy that goes way, way, way back, and that is the question. Of course, it's the nature of religion, but in particular, the question of whether religion is useful or not—is it good for anything, or is it some kind of pathology? And the reason that religion is so captivating, fascinates us, especially fascinates the rational mind and the scientific mind, is that it does not appear utilitarian. The beliefs are counterfactual, so these are beliefs with no evidence, and the practices that the beliefs cause often seem to be costly. So we note puzzle over utilitarian things, you know, why we make spears, you know, that's obvious, but why we pray to fictional beings, and why we do all sorts of things, even sacrifice our lives for these fictional beings, that's a mystery.
I was going to say that there are certain things that human beings very often behave counter to their nature. I mean, you know, we put ourselves in danger because it's the right, quote unquote, the right thing to do sometimes, right? We'll sacrifice our lives. We'll you know, it may be very dangerous to jump into a river and save somebody, but we'll do it. That's a huge part of being human.
Well, that's right. So that's back to being groupish and to being altruistic, whether or not quite apart from religion. But returning to the nature of religion, if you go way back to when scholarship began on this topic, then there were some people who were arguing that basically religion is not useful. It might be, for example, you know, a form of superstition, something that will yield to science, so on and so forth. Or we have Emile Durkheim, the father of sociology, who was the son of a rabbi. And in his great book, The Elementary Forms of Religious Life, he says that despite appearances, religion has great secular utility is what the way he put it.
I love that.
And then he gave his famous definition of religion, which I can't quote exactly, but it's basically it's a system of beliefs and practices that's centered around the sacred, which unite into one single moral community called a church. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, Durkheim had a functional interpretation of religion in contrast to other interpretations. So this basic distinction is religion useful or not? And also, is it useful at the level of a community, a group, or is it just useful for individuals? All of these things were being debated way back then. Now we fast forward to the time when evolutionists became involved. And we're really asking the same questions, but we're asking it through a new lens, through a modern evolutionary lens. Now, I actually have to respectfully disagree with you a little bit about your portrayal of Dawkins, because I think Dawkins is happy to say that religion is a product of evolution, but he would call it something like a byproduct,
mm-hmm.
therefore not useful,
yeah.
or a cultural parasite, mm-hmm. therefore not useful. Mm. These are fully evolutionary explanations of religion, but they weigh on the side of religion not being useful.
Right.
Whereas myself, and now I think it's becoming a consensus, when I wrote Darwin's Cathedral, it was a minority position, but I think it's become the consensus among serious scholars of religion from an evolutionary perspective, is that basically religion is good for the group. More or less, Durkheim was right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and of course it needs lots of updating, but I think it's important to be aware of the deep history of this topic and of the basic controversy, and to recognize that the role of evolution is to provide a lot of modern science, basically, which enables us to answer these questions more definitively than we could before.
Could you draw a distinction, though, between, for example, one of the things that Judeo-Christian ethic has given us is the idea that we are all of the same moral worth because we come from the same father. That's a monotheistic belief structure. But what about polytheistic belief structures? What about Hinduism that doesn't have that?
Well, I love the example in the book about, you know, and Haight uses this as well, probably taken from you, of the Balinese water temples.
Yes.
Would you mind explaining to our listeners that example?
Yes, it is the most wonderful example because just to say what it is, it's a religion, but it's a religion with a very specific purpose, which is to coordinate agriculture, especially rice agriculture, which is a very complex process because they have a whole big irrigation system to maintain. You have to distribute the water. There's a trade-off between water and pest control. It's a very, very complex system, and it's on the most functional things, growing your food, and the whole thing is orchestrated by a religion with temples at every node of the irrigation system, culminating at the grand temple at the top of the mountain and the high priests and the virgins. And, and so the combination of the most otherworldly of cultural institutions, this particular religion, which is very, very polytheistic, and the most practical of all things, growing your food, is really like a symbolic, you know, the perfect symbol of the way we're trying to study all religions. And to talk a little bit more about polytheism, at every node of the irrigation system defines, there's a temple. And that temple defines a group of people that are responsible for maintaining the irrigation system up to that node. And the way that's managed culturally is that every temple has its own separate deities whose province, basically, is to manage just that. So the water temple system is polytheistic, and that only addresses one aspect of Balinese life. And so for other aspects of life, there's still more temples, more gods, more...
But it still has the effect of unifying a culture.
It is still very, very communitarian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In this case, it seems hierarchical and actually is hierarchical, but that does not prevent it from being functional. And so the question as to the functionality of a cultural system and the degree to which, and its structure basically, the degree to which it's egalitarian versus hierarchical are separate questions basically. It's like two by two tables. It can be hierarchical or egalitarian, it can be functional or not. And it's possible for any one of those combinations to exist.
But still very useful. So religion is really here to stay, isn't it, from your perspective?
Well, I mean,
In other words, what I'm really doing is saying, you know, if you hear Dawkins and certain, you know, and some of these atheists, like Krauss, I get the feeling that they, in their mind, as we learn more and more about science, as science explains more and more things, even sort of the chemical reaction that might be love or whatever it is, that, you know, we're going to look back on religion and think how trite that was, just back in our old ancestors actually believed in all that superstitious stuff.
Right.
But I don't know about that. I think in many ways, you know, as technology, you know, advances exponentially the way it is, there seems to be a pushback where people go, whoa, wait a minute, I'm losing my religion. And I don't know that that's very healthy, but I certainly think that it sounds to me like, you know, they may be missing the mark.
I was just having a conversation about this the other day, and what it focused on was the degree to which people are able to partition their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And on one side, they can be scientists to the bone, and on the other side, they can be religious to the bone, and they can just toggle back and forth between the two. And you see this now in a lot of evangelical churches. I mean, they are as, you know, fundamentalist as you could be.
But they're still going to get antibiotics and an X-ray.
Well, they're certainly creationists. You know, they would say that they don't believe in evolution. But the various people that join them are, you know, even university presidents, and very, very educated people. And when you think about that and you say, boy, how can that be? I think you don't have to think long before you realize that cultures have always been like that. And it's a philosophical conceit. It's the conceit of intellectuals to think that we want some system that basically, you know, self-consistent system that covers everything. Just about every culture in existence has been of the partition variety. Basically, you do this in this situation, you do that in that situation. Do you need to knit together this and that? No, not necessarily. And so the idea of partitioning is, I think, important. And then when you realize that what religions are designed to do is to motivate action, and that fictions, I call them adaptive fictions, basically, stuff that's not true, but nevertheless effectively motivates action. If you look at the trade-off, so here, let me just step back a little bit. I often like to distinguish between two kinds of realism, which I call factual realism and practical realism. And their definitions are straightforward. Basically, an idea or belief is practically realistic if it causes you to do something useful. It is factually realistic when it's true in the scientific sense of the word. It accurately describes what's out there. So that's easy enough to articulate. Now the question is, what's the trade-off between them? I mean, if you're going to have a set of beliefs which are like really score high on practical realism, is it also possible for it to score high on factual realism? And there's some cases in which it does. There's actually a positive correlation. The more you the more you understand things in a factual sense, the more practical you can be. But there's many, many, many situations in which the trade-off is negative. And in order to the beliefs that cause you to behave in the most practical way are fictions. They require you to depart from factual reality. And that's a statement not just for religions, but for secular beliefs. One of the ironies is that atheists of the Richard Dawkins variety depart from factual reality in their own way. They cannot see religion clearly because they hate it so much. And so they have their own departures from factual a reality, their own ideology, which is actually quite a fundamentalist ideology. And, of course, isn't that ironic?
Yeah, it sure is ironic. And, you know, whenever I think about Richard Dawkins, he serves a purpose, of course. But if I lose a child, I don't need Richard Dawkins. I need somebody who's going to, I don't know, I'm not a very religious guy, but I need a priest or a rabbi or a Buddhist monk or somebody to tell me that suffering is human, and I don't know what I need. But I know that a scientist ain't going to help me out of that. Well, out of that sorrow and that pain. I don't want somebody explaining to me why, when I listen to a piece of music, I feel profoundly joyous and sad at the same time.
But Brian,
I'm not
you
interested.
Do. You do. Because the point
is, I'm saying
is,
that I don't need that as a human being.
Yes,
I'm
you
saying
do.
That,
because the point is, and you keep on saying it's this or that, and it's not. The point is that you also want to understand why is it that, you know, people have loss aversion, for example, and it causes me to do stupid things. Why is it that even though I know I should wear a condom when I have sex, I sometimes go ahead with it anyway.
I beg your pardon. but you're right.
The,
oh, you're
we
right.
need
you're
both,
right.
and I think
you
that's
both,
the thing, is that we
right.
need to keep on, we need
but
to
don't
really
take
stop.
Away, don't take away the wonder and magic with your, you know, that I feel like Richard Dawkins wants to do that to me,
and religious people want to do the same thing with science. What yeah. both sides are trying to do is deny aspects of our humanity, and what we really want is to embrace all of that, because the wonder that comes out of understanding the universe that you get from watching something like Cosmos or whatever, or from understanding that there is a unifying explanation for all of the forms of life on Earth, like, that's just as profound and wonderful. I mean, you know, as it says in Inherit the Wind, right? There is more wonder in a child's ability to recite a multiplication table than there is in all of your superstition or whatever it is. It's not – I don't agree with that. I think there's wonder in all of it. But
Professor?
Yeah?
Your thoughts?
Oh, I was having such a great time. You guys are carrying the show here.
Yeah, no, I love when I said that, I had a feeling Hunter was gonna
It drives me nuts. This is the thing that drives me most nuts about Brian. I love him. He's an amazing individual, but he keeps on trying to be like, you scientists with your reason can't appreciate music. Yeah, and you know, Einstein was a violinist.
I don't talk that way. That's a bad impression of me, by the way.
It's a terrible one.
Professor, back me up on that.
Well, let's say back you up on that as a bad impression.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, not my point of view, but
well, I think, you know, I perversely feel like sticking up for Richard Dawkins a little bit here.
Good.
You know, you list his book titles, and they include An Appetite for Wonder and The Magic of Reality. And, of course, one of the things he wants you to know is that you can fully have, you know, all of the wonder that we associate with religion is available to an atheist. And, you know, that's when Carl Sagan certainly represents that kind of thing also. Mm. So I think that for me, it comes back to meaning systems, a way to interpret the what happens in this world, both good and bad. And the death of a child, I think, is a great example. And let's go back to that 2x2 table. Basically, you know, you might be religious or not, and you might be able to cope with the death of a child well or not. And I think that this is, again, you can easily find cases of all four possibility. We know, not just with Darwin, but with Huxley, they both lost children and found it tremendously hard to bear. Religion provided very little solace. Mm. And actually, in their case, so did science. They were just miserable.
Mm.
And they found that nothing consoled them. Now, you get people that are consoled by religion, but you can also find many, many people that will console themselves with a meaning system, basically making sense of what happened that happens to be a secular explanation, not a religious explanation. So it's the meaning system. Religion fascinates us, so we really need to nest it within the subject, within the larger category of meaning systems. And when you do that, then we return to one of your early questions, will religion always be with us? I actually say no, not necessarily, because it's possible that the meaning systems of the future are not religious. They do the job of meaning systems, but they manage to be more respectful of factual realism than current our religions. And for me, that's almost a goal. I mean, it is a goal, basically. I hope that the meaning system of the future is one that is highly respectful of science, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So no adaptive fictions, please. We stick to the truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it does what a meaning system does, and that is enables us to process information and to behave in ways that's just beneficial, not just to ourselves, but sustainable for the whole planet. And, you know, that's a tremendous information processing task. How do we do that? How do we create a meaning system that actually takes in information and causes us to behave in ways that's sustainable at a planetary scale and feel good doing it?
Well, with the truth, right? I mean,
it's a little more complicated than that. I mean, we had John Durand on, who wrote the Paleo Manifesto, and he sort of really went through Mosaic Law and the fact that much of it is just basically, you know, Bronze Age microbiology. Right. Uh-huh. A lot of those behaviors are adaptive in the sense that, you know, washing your hands, you know, using clean plates, like, you know, separating out different food products, that all is basic microbiology and was adaptive in the sense that it kept them healthy. Obviously, now we've moved towards an adaptive fiction that is closer to factual fiction. Most people don't understand, you know, the differences between viruses and bacteria. They just think there are these sort of magical creatures called germs. That when you wash your hand, the germies go away, right? So, I mean, that has happened in certain areas of life. But I think it's important to realize that it's not necessarily that people have factual fictions. They have adaptive fictions that are simplified versions of those factual fictions.
I would agree with that.
And I think that's the thing. We can continue to do that with all of these things, even an understanding like Durkheim's or, you know, the idea of homo duplex, that we have these two natures, right? There's sort of secular profane man, and then we have the ability to be bonded together into these massive religious groups and be lifted out of ourselves.
Altruistic groups too, right,
yeah.
Professor?
Yeah.
You know, altruism is a byproduct of evolution.
Well, I would not say it was a byproduct. I mean, it's an outcome of evolution. And this is, we're segueing into a slightly different topic, but one which is central to all of this is the whole concept of group selection. Can something evolve that benefits whole groups? When we behave in ways that's for the good of the group at our own expense, often at our own expense, is this something that can be explained as a product of evolution? And the answer once was no. We have to explain everything as beneficial at the individual level. In some sense, everything is selfish, and of course, Dawkins is the icon for that view. Now, I think again, there's been a sea change, and now we know that actually it happens not all the time, but much of the time that it is indeed the case that something that evolves because it benefits the whole group, it can evolve despite being selectively disadvantageous within groups. And then religion is a great example of that, as a set of adaptations which create strong groups like organisms. And that's a metaphor that they themselves use. They say, we are like a single body. We are like a beehive.
Mm-hmm.
And now, actually, science can, that's just not metaphorical. We can now affirm that scientifically. We can say, yes, you are.
Yeah, you're a hive.
And just to give you your due, you've been at the vanguard of leading that idea of multi-level selection theory, right? That selection can happen at the level of groups.
Me plus a few friends, yeah. I mean, I'm often portrayed as the Lone Ranger, but it's a fascinating period in the history of evolutionary thought, and there was definitely a dark age for a group selection, and a very, very few people were trying to reestablish it, and I'm proud to be among them.
I bet, man. That's a
that's
pretty
awesome
cool legacy there.
Yeah.
You have there's a quote here, D.S. Wilson and his co-author E.O. Wilson, I'm reading from Wikipedia, have become well known for the quote, selfishness beats altruism within groups, altruistic groups beat selfish groups, everything else is commentary.
Right.
Can you expand on that?
Well, of course, it's taken from Rabbi Hillel, who was asked to explain the meaning of the Torah while standing on one foot. But that really is it in a nutshell. And what's surprising is, and basically, that was Darwin's insight. If you go back to Darwin, and everyone in that period, I mean, here was this amazing theory of evolution that explained everything, but it had a number of, you know, major challenges, and one of those was altruistic behavior, basically, based behaviors that are for the good of the group. Because clearly, if I'm doing something which is increasing your survival and reproduction at the expense of my own, you'd think that how could that evolve, basically? And Darwin, so this is like a huge deal for Darwin, because most of the human behaviors which count as moral, and many animal behaviors, such as the famous honeybees, you know, are of this sort. So these are things that are out there. We hope that they not only exist in, among humans, but are important among humans. And yet evolution at the individual level cannot explain them. And Darwin's solution was very simply that, okay, it's true that the brave person, the loyal person, the honest person are vulnerable to exploitation within the groups. You can't really explain why they do better, why the altruist does better than the selfish individuals within within a group. But you can't explain how an altruistic group does better than a selfish group. That's a no-brainer.
So
therefore, if evolution operates at the level of between group selection is a force that favors altruism, and within group selection is a force that favors selfishness. So selfishness beats altruism within groups. That's within group selection. Altruistic groups.
In other words, let me put that into context. I remember Viktor Frankl's book, I think it was, where he said that the good ones, the good people in the concentration camps didn't survive. It was the ones that had to be very selfish. And I mean, I don't mean to say the survivors were in concentration camps were bad. I just mean Viktor Frankl was suggesting.
Oh, because I just tweeted that out,
yeah,
Brian.
I was just I just mean that one of the things that Viktor Frankl said is, a lot of people in that terrible situation who put others first didn't make it. Whereas
you said something else, but you illustrate the point, basically, is that in a situation like that, well, I mean, it's a single group and under extremely dire circumstances, then if you are the altruistic person, of course, you are doing things on behalf of others at your own expense. And that is costly. And you might expect those people to. Whereas if you hoard food, for example, just make it as simple as whether you share food or hoard it, because it could be that simple. Or make it as simple as whether you try to protect somebody or you give them up.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are moral dilemmas. And if you do the immoral option, basically, most of what we call immoral is basically benefiting yourself at the expense of others. And in a concentration camp situation, of course, you're making it extremely costly to be moral. In a more normal situation, it's less costly to be moral, and it's more costly to be selfish, because there's a whole arsenal of social control mechanisms that punishes various forms of selfishness.
Yeah, if you get found out to be a sociopath, you're going to get found out, and nobody's going to do business with you, as an example, you know.
That's right. So, and you know, I'm finding more and more in especially the business world, because following John Hyde, who's now moved to the Stern School of Business at NYU, I'm also joining him in the study of business from an evolutionary perspective. And business is so often portrayed as nature red in tooth and claw. You know, you have to be hard-headed. You might be altruistic at home, but you can't be altruistic at business. Do you know that all that's bullshit?
I know. Because happy companies with self-motivated people innovate, and they're not going to compete in today's world. You can't have a. We had Robert Greene on, who wrote the 48 Laws of Power, very Machiavellian. And then we had
Dasher Keltner,
who's a professor of sociology at
Berkeley,
who basically said that doesn't work. Being Machiavellian in business is not going to help you out, man. It's you're going to get found out. Even in schools, the kids that have the most power are the ones with the biggest hearts that take care of everybody. And certainly, I think viable businesses, if they're going to compete in this ever-changing economy and create products we want, you've got to have everybody working to, you know, you've got to create happy workers that are motivated. It's just too competitive otherwise, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would have to say, three quarters, yes, but it really is both of those things. Selfishness beats altruism within groups. Altruistic groups beat selfish groups. And then what you get depends on the relative strength of those forces. And often what you get is a mix. This is true in many, many species, basically. It's not just one side, one strategy doesn't win. what you end up with is a mix. So some people are succeeding through selfishness. Other people are succeeding through altruism. I shouldn't have said people because it's so cross-specific. So you end up with a mix. But the idea that group selection never operates, that within group selection always trumps between group selection, that is what's proven to be, you know, flat out incorrect, just plain wrong. And so what we have is the more complicated situation, especially when you extend it to multiple levels. And human life is just it's like Russian dolls. I mean, there's groups within groups within groups, and in each level, this plays itself out. Again, I'm doing some work. The Evolution Institute is doing some work at Norway, studying Norway as an example of a nation that's extremely successful. I noticed that you interviewed Darren Eitsmoglu, author of Why Nations Fail. Great book.
Yeah, great book.
And so Norway consistently scores high in all indices of economic vitality and quality of life. So they're a nation that functions very well for its people. But when Norway makes investment decisions for its pension fund, guess what? They turn selfish.
Yeah.
They invest in all kinds of stuff that's raping the earth, basically, because it's returning a profit for Norway.
Yeah.
I was going to say, be careful. You're starting to sound, if you start going down this path of altruism, we start sounding a little bit like socialists or even, God forbid, communists.
Well, the truth is
there's room, there's both.
Yeah, and that was part of the point that Dacher Keltner made. It's not that, you know, Machiavellian strategies don't work. In fact, they specifically do work in situations like 15th century Italy where, you know, you have competing city-states, it's very violent, all of that sort of stuff. But in a modern society which has, by and large, rule of law and things like that, it doesn't work. You're far better off being altruistic.
Again, but I mean, I think that there's still a niche for Machiavellianism.
Hollywood.
And, you know, high-frequency trading and things like that. But the point is that it depends a lot on the social environment, whether the balance between levels of selection. This is how we describe it in multi-level selection theory. There's a balance between levels of selection, and that depends very much on the social environment. And the social environment in humans can be controlled, basically. It can be engineered. And so we can create social environments which really stack the deck in favor of altruism. It makes it very difficult to cheat, to be Machiavellian, really hard to do that. And you drive that down to a very low frequency. On the other hand, if you don't do that, then there will be social environments in which basically the deck is stacked in favor of selfishness.
Yeah.
And if you try to be altruistic in a situation like that, good luck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it all comes down to a matter of enlightened social engineering. And in order to do that, you have to resurrect the word social engineering, because basically that's a stigmatized word.
That makes me nervous. Yeah, it makes me nervous.
Why does it make you nervous?
Because I like how the marketplace just works itself out. Whenever I hear social engineering, I think of a lot of smart people coming in and saying, we're going to drive down the impulse of selfishness and drive up or create a favorable area of circumstances for altruism. And then I start thinking about, well, nobody's a winner, nobody gets a trophy, and that's not the way the world works. It just doesn't. There are some people that are better than other people at certain things, and they should be rewarded. Some people work harder. Some people are, sorry to use the word, Hunter, smarter in certain contexts, or their
brains
are
better. You don't have to use more things than other people.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know,
But you have to let those things fall. You have to let that deck, you've got to let things fall naturally.
Yeah,
and then
Brian, let
that work itself out.
I've got some news for you.
Yeah.
The market is structured. The market is not a free-for-all. There are parameters that are put on, rule of law.
Nobody's
talking
about that. I'm just talking about be careful with social engineering, you know.
No, but that's, I mean, yes. So, yes, be careful about social engineering, but appropriately structured markets is a form of social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So this has to be smart social engineering. It cannot be too top-down.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be like heavy-handed Soviet five-year plans.
Right.
It has to make use of smart use of market processes. More generally, it has to make use of the fact that complex social systems are self-organizing.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it has to make use of the fact that complex social systems are inherently difficult to predict. We have to be humble. We have to be experimental, and so on. So I think all of these things need to be worked through, basically. And this involves a lot of work, basically, a lot of intellectual work, so that people can feel comfortable talking about social engineering, knowing that it's going to be of the smart variety, the humble and smart variety, yeah, as opposed to the arrogant and variety.
Well, and I think it's so important along those lines that the public be engaged in that discussion.
I think it's also important to realize where social engineering doesn't, where it should not be applied versus where it should be applied.
Yeah.
And I think you just talked about that, Professor.
Well, and the
markets
example,
are self-regulating, et cetera.
The example that I love is actually from Nudge, which is Thaler and Sunstein's book, which is if you put any item in a cafeteria or a supermarket at eye level, people are more likely to choose that. That's just the reality. That's mm-hmm. a quirk of human biology. So
right.
knowing that, what do you put at eye level? Do you put the French fries there or do you put the salads there? Or do you randomize it?
Mm.
The point is that once you have insights like that or the sort of insights that Professor Wilson is talking about, you can't unhave that insight. You know that. You know that that has an effect. And then you have to choose whether to apply that knowledge or not.
Mm.
Yeah, so there's a good book. In fact, I have some. I don't need to do it online, but I have some more suggestions for speakers for you that address these. Hold on a second.
Great.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. And while you're thinking of that, I wanted to ask you something else. It seems, and we've touched on this, but you know, it seems that all groups, even when they do terrible things, try to justify what they did on moral grounds. There is a moral relativism. I mean, my God, even the Nazis had this idea that they were solving a problem. You know, if you're playing Stalin as an actor, you can't play him like he's a monster. You know, your acting teacher will tell you got to play him like he's trying to solve a problem. I'm sorry, but that's you've got to figure out a way to make him human, which is look, these people aren't falling into line and they're making it much worse. I'm going to kill a million people today for the betterment of 20 million tomorrow. But isn't it true that we all, no matter how bad a group behaves, there is this idea that they're behaving for the better good at the end of the day for everybody. That seems to be very human, a moral sense, even if it's corrupt.
I agree with that 85%. You're doing very well with me.
So you're saying we have a B.
85% is a B. I'll take a B, man. I wasn't a good student. I'll take a B. Yeah.
So here's the only thing I would change about it. I do agree that almost everything we do think is moral. We're not evil in our own minds, basically.
Mm.
But at the same time, often there's a question as to whether we think we're being moral for everyone or whether we think we're being moral for our group. And I think in many cases, being moral for our group is good enough because we've dehumanized everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And our group has become the humans. So it's been said it's like an anthropological commonplace that in most indigenous tribes, the word for the tribe is humans.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not a member of our tribe, you're not a human. We classify you with the animals.
Yeah.
When the Germans referred to the Jews as stock, as in livestock.
Yeah.
So, and it's, I talked to one anthropologist who works in New Guinea, and this was really frightening. She said that you'd think, you know, it's kind of, we think that if two groups, you know, ethnic groups have been coexisting for a long time, then that should lead to stability and harmony and things like that, just by virtue that they have a long history together. But what she told me was that when you get adjacent ethnic groups in New Guinea that have been coexisting amicably for a long time, and then something changes about the ecological situation, which makes it possible for one group to exploit the other, they can do that on a dime.
Wow.
They just have a meeting and they begin to tell tall tales about the other group, outrageous falsehoods, and they dehumanize them. It can happen in an afternoon.
Amazing.
And then they go about their duty. Now, they think they're being moral, but they, because they've drawn the moral circle around themselves, they feel no need to be moral about the other group any more than we feel we need to be moral about cockroaches.
Wow.
And that's what you call those people, is cockroaches or the equivalent.
Yep.
So yes, it's true that we're all moral in our own minds, but we also have a moral circle. And when we draw the moral circle narrowly, then then we don't, by definition, you do not extend morality outside your moral circle.
And I think that's the thing. I think that's a really good example of the key is not to deny that aspect of our nature, but to understand it so we can be aware of it. And so that we can, you know, as soon as we start doing that, our antenna can go up and we can be like, oh, we're dehumanizing these people. Let's be aware of that, and so on and so forth.
Mm. Right. Now, let me mention a couple of books on the air because your readers, your listeners can immediately go out and get them, in addition to these being maybe future speakers. The first book is called Complexity and the Art of Public Policy, Solving Society's Problems from the Bottom Up.
Wow.
The authors are David Kolander and Roland Coopers, and it's a beautiful book on complexity theory and how that provides a foundation for public policy in this humble way that I was talking about. So I think that if you were to read this, you would be pleased. Basically, you would approve. This is the right kind of social engineering.
Great.
And the other book is called Give and Take by Adam Grant, who is a business professor at the Wharton Business School. Give and Take, Why Helping Others Drives Our Success by Adam Grant. He is the youngest professor to receive tenure at the Wharton School of Business. And and this is a wonderful book on how basically giving is can be a successful business strategy, but only if it's suitably protected. One of the things he said is that the givers do the best and the worst.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because unrestricted giving, you know, dumb giving, just giving without any strings attached, is a recipe for disaster.
Well, it's got to be married to justice, too. I mean, you can't just be one thing. You've got to have, you know, right? I mean, there's got to be a just reason for giving or you know, you got to look at a lot of different factors.
Exactly. You have to be conditional, basically.
Yeah.
Giving, and when you make giving conditional, it remains giving. You might think, oh, that's not altruistic anymore because you put strings on it. But that's stupid. I mean, it's still altruistic. It's just that it's a form of smart altruism.
Yeah. I think Ayn Rand had that really difficult question. Would you rather give money to a starving genius or a pregnant slut? I mean, that's good old Ayn Rand, but I mean, you know.
Oh, Jesse, yeah, I know. I'm gonna have to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, but if you think about it, yeah, that's a very good question, and most of us know the answer. I don't care if you say it out loud, but we know the answer. I'm giving it to the starving genius because she's pregnant and she's not of use to me. No, I'm kidding. No, but Professor, let me ask you this. We won't take too much more of your time. Sociopaths. Is there any evolutionary evidence that sociopaths are, do they play a role? It just feels like all the great leaders like Napoleon and Genghis Khan and certainly Mao Zedong and all these a-holes who created all these wars, they weren't great military, they may have been great military leaders. They were sociopaths, it sounds like to me. They just weren't worried about killing just millions of people for their own, you know, I guess legacy or glory or this idea they had. Have there been any studies on the role of a sociopath, why they occur in nature and why this happens?
Yeah, I have another book for you here. And this is by the same person who was the lead editor of our pathological altruism book.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Her name is Barbara Oakley. And one of her books is titled, you will like this title, Evil Genes, Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend.
Wow.
Wow.
Shit, I'm all over that book.
And it is all about what basically she calls borderline personality disorder, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which exists in forms small and large. So basically, she will interpret these world leaders that you talked about and her own sister from this perspective. And she actually has quite a nuanced view. It's the view is more nuanced than the title. It's not just a matter of genes. It's more complicated than that. But the point is that this is back to the fact that Machiavellianism is alive and well. And although there's many protections against it, this is like the immune system. There's also diseases that manage to circumvent the immune system. And so there are people that manage to insinuate themselves into position of powers, no matter how much carnage and wreckage they leave along the way. And they'll bring down entire corporations or nations or families in the process of this strategy, which works for them at great expense to others. Those folks exist, basically, and we should expect them to exist from an evolutionary perspective. The only reason that we're so well protected against them is because of a long evolutionary history of their presence. So I think your intuition is right, and glad to tell you about a book that that develops that thesis.
I am all over that book. Why my sister stole my mother's boyfriend.
Yeah,
that's all she had to say. Yeah. The other stuff I didn't even hear. That's what I like.
No,
I'm,
but it was
I'm
good.
Ready.
It was good foreplay. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. You know, you talk about Hitler. You know, evil genes, and then bam, Jerry Springer.
Professor, this has been fantastic. We can't thank you enough for joining us here, and I consider it. I've said this before, not often, but I consider it a privilege to talk to a seminal thinker like yourself. So thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you, and thanks for all that you do to improve the quality of intellectual life.
Well, we try, man. You know, we live in a culture that celebrates athletes and celebrities, and I think you guys are the ones that need to be heard and listened to. I think
you're also much more interesting.
Yeah. So, yes,
and,
indeed.
And just to say, you know, thank you for that B. I think, you know, Brian and I are really impressed that we even managed to get that. And in our books, you get an A+.
There you go. There it is. Do you follow any pop culture, Professor? I'm just out of curiosity. Do you watch TMZ? Do you watch the Kardashians or any of that stuff?
Oh, you know, for the most part, no. I'm kind of a Luddite that way. Why do you ask?
I don't know. I just like to know, you know. I know you spend your time thinking about subjects and you know, basically arguing with other very smart people for your position, but I just always like to hear.
Yeah, what do you do for fun? I mean, do you hike? Do you, I mean, what is there to do in
Binghamton?
Hey,
don't get too personal. Don't get too personal.
Well, you know, I mean, if I'm ever in Binghamton, New York, I want to know what are the cool spots to hang out at.
Yeah.
Oh, well, first of all, you should come visit me, and my current hobby is to turn a swimming pool into a pond, and so I'm a biologist at heart, and I just thrive on being outdoors. Just get me out of doors and I'm happy, basically.
There it is. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. All right, if you want to find him, he'll be outdoors with a bandana. Professor, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. It's great.
Yeah, awesome, right?
Yeah, great guy. Yeah, man. It's just another example of just, you know, it's just mind expanding, you know? Don't ever contradict me on
Brian.
Hunter, don't you
Brian,
ever
you have like
don't ever contradict me on my podcast.
Listen, we
I'm
all
I'm fake Sicilian and where I don't come
you,
from.
I know you are. But listen, we all have our weird little narratives. I have mine, you have yours, and yours
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. I'll keep making that mistake. You gotta keep correcting me.
Until you move past that and embrace that we are scientists.
We are all of it.
The totality of humanity, Brian.
I know.
You know. Brian, are you wearing your shades indoors?
Yeah, man.
Are you a celebrity?
I am. I don't like being recognized even within the booth of my own podcast.
Yeah.
All right, kids, I'm going to hit the beach. My kids are there.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. This has been the Brian Callen Hunter.
No, it's the Brian Callen Show.
No, it's not. Later.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.